This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rasky, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice for the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Jonathan Hennessy, a New York Times bestselling author and the producer, and in some cases, if you can be a star of a documentary, the star of a new documentary called You Don't Understand the Second Amendment. Welcome to Wade's World, Jonathan.
Oh, wait, it's a great pleasure. Thank you. And hello to your audience in the great Southeast.
Yeah, you got it. So, boy, you know how to pick a subject. The Second Amendment, that's a little bit toxic. And you will start right out in the title saying, hey, dude, you don't even understand the Second Amendment. So how did you come to do this documentary?
Great question. So I'm mostly known as, to the extent that I'm known at all, which is, you know, very moderately, if I can even say that at all. I'm known for these sort of graphic novels of U.S. history. So these are nonfiction books. The first one I had the chance to do was a graphic novel style, so it looks like a comic book, but it's the whole U.S. Constitution adapted into that form. So it's for everything from the phrase all seven articles, all 27 amendments, in a way that people can actually read it. I think it's the first time it was ever put into that form. So the book is, you know, roughly close to 200 pages, and I knew going into it that that dedicating any amount of space to that the Second Amendment was going to be tough to cover such a big topic in a small way. But when I was researching the Constitution, Wade, it impressed me again and again how much eye-opening and good information there is about the whole subject out there, but that just doesn't seem to make it to most people. And even after, adapting the Constitution to this more like democratic form that's easy for people to read, I still felt like there was a lot on the table. And for some people, the Second Amendment is the Constitution.
No question, and graphic novels have become, wow, so popular compared to, say, even 10 years ago. Jonathan, let's just get into this. You know the classic arguments about the Second Amendment. People argue, particularly conservatives, that we have the right to bear arms, any kind of arms, anytime, almost anywhere. Your documentary sort of unpacks this with some important sort of historical revelations for those people who may not remember or never knew some of the history. Let's just go back to that. So what is the core misunderstanding people have about the Second Amendment?
It's amazing, Wade, the way that that myths that we have in our culture can be more powerful than facts. And the gun extremists, and this is really something that's been going on just over the last couple of generations, like, say, 30 or 40 years, because the Second Amendment wasn't a controversial thing for the first, 180 years of its existence. It's really a testament to how successful the extremists have been in reframing the narrative, and they've even made it so that progressives really don't question what, say, a group like the NRA's interpretation of the Second Amendment is. They've sort of got us all to agree on what it is.
They've framed the debate, haven't they?
Exactly. And so you're obviously, Wade, very conversant with the subject because you named like three of the the biggest misunderstandings about it right there, that it means that these are rights that every man, woman, and child has, that it means any weapon that, you know, any weapon that like a military force would use is something that an individual would have, and that that the amendment was placed there to allow individuals to, you know, take up arms against the federal government on an individual basis if they felt like the federal government was becoming tyrannical. And all three of these arguments are historically unsupportable.
You start, you know, there's a big argument, certainly in the Supreme Court. We have several justices who now argue they're originalist, going back to how the original authors of the Constitution might have intended. One of your strongest arguments is that the original authors saw guns in a very specific way, and it was one way looking at domestically and another looking at militarily. Why don't you describe for our listeners exactly how this really probably works?
Yeah, Wade, if I could leave your listeners with just one message, it would be that, you know, especially in the case of the Second Amendment, is that this originalism that the conservative groups love to talk about, that is really not their friend, not on their side when it comes to the Second Amendment. So, I mean, yeah, let's get into the history. One of the biggest misunderstandings that people have about the Second Amendment is they believe, you know, this right was placed in the Constitution, this protection of this right to allow anyone to be able to keep and bear firearms. So we look at this word, you know, the people. It says that, the security of a free state, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And so we look at this word people and we think that means everyone. And that is sort of how we use the word today. But if you go back to the Constitution and you go back to the times that this document was made and that it was ratified, the word people does really not mean everyone at all. You know, we're proud patriots and devoted Americans. We don't like to think that our society was set up to have second-class citizens, to have some people who don't have these rights, political rights like the right to vote, the right to serve in the militia, the right to keep firearms. But so we look at people, look at this word people today in the Second Amendment and see and say, oh, this is a protection of a right for everyone. But in the Constitution, the word people only means those who are given these who are thought just to exercise these political rights, the right to vote, the right to serve in the militia, the right to be on a jury. And this did not mean everyone, because, as you know, anybody who's taken
quite the contrary.
Exactly. So, you know, people who are in the gun extremist crowd sort of say that the government has no right choosing who gets to keep a firearm or not. But just by choosing the word people in the Constitution, that is setting up the government to do exactly that, because the government was set up for, in those, you know, famous first three words of the preamble, you know, we the people. And there was a whole classes of people when the country was first being set up who didn't have these rights, like slaves, prisoners, women. In many places, even free African Americans didn't have these kinds of rights. So in the Constitution, when you see the word persons, that really does mean everyone. But people is automatically a division of the populace into what they felt were the responsible adult citizens, the people who could be trusted with power. And so, you know, therefore, government does get to make a division between who can be trusted as a citizen and who does not. So the Second Amendment protects the rights of the people, not the persons to bear arms. So just out of the gate, it means not everyone was meant to have this right. There was a common sense barrier there.
Even perhaps if people don't agree on that interpretation, the line that you do such a good job of drawing between domestic personal use versus military understanding is very important from the Constitution about
Absolutely.
Gun rights.
Absolutely. So when we, you know, somebody from the other side would argue, hey, look, you know, even the founding fathers, these were all men. These were all guys who had firearms. And, you know, and you can even look at some – the man who's known as sort of the father of the Constitution, James Madison, in the Federalist Number 46, he talks about that it's a big advantage of Americans being armed. But the question here is, what kind of firearms are we talking about? And again, this documentary is full of historical primary sources. This isn't about my opinion. Every assertion in here is backed up by a huge amount of evidence. And the evidence that we have, the founding fathers owning and the people of that generation owning firearms, we get this from probate records and we get this from estate inventories. And we can see the kind of weapons that these people actually owned. And they were the kind of weapons that Americans have historically, you know, preferred to protect their own lives and their own property. So basically things, you know, at the time that were like single action, shotguns, handguns, and rifles. What we know, Americans of the 1780s, 1790s, early Republic, and on, Wade, what we know that these people weren't keeping and bearing for themselves were military-grade weapons. Weapons like that were used only in a military or a militia context, like cannon, mortars, and howitzers. These are the kinds of things that you'd use as an actual military force when military action, you know, when that level of deadliness is called for. And you can go back, and the kinds of weapons that we have today, the kind of like semi-automatic weapons that a lot of people in the media like to call assault rifles. So things like the so-called AR-15s that were used at, you know, Sandy Hook and Las Vegas and other attacks like that, we can see that these weapons that we have today that are street legal are actually the equivalent of weapons of war from our founding fathers' time. These weapons are actually provably scientifically more deadly than cannon, mortars, and howitzers were at the time that the Constitution was being written and ratified and the war for American independence was going on.
Exactly right. We're talking to Jonathan Hennessy, who's an author, and in this case, we're talking about a new documentary he's created called You Don't Understand the Second Amendment. And perhaps equally important misunderstanding is this sort of, and this is very prevalent on the extreme right, is this right to be part of a militia to overturn the government. That's one that you have a lot of things in the documentary to explicate.
That's right, Wade. So, you know, there is no doubt that the militia was an important idea to, you know, many of the founding fathers. And one thing that if you take the time to watch the documentary that you will learn, which, you know, I think is kind of common sense to us today, but was even common sense then, that a militia as opposed to a standing army was really not the most effective military response to any kind of national security or emergency concern. You know, even in the 1780s, when the Constitution was being written and ratified, the idea of a militia taking the place of a standing army, it was an idea that a lot of Americans had, but it was already kind of an outdated and outmoded thing, you know, 220 years ago. We've gotten so far from the facts of even, you know, where as a nation we came from that I often hear people say that, you know, in the American Revolution, there was no standing army. All the fighting was done by the militia. You know, that's not true at all. You can go back. One of the major reasons that we even won our war for independence was because they created a professional army, the Continental Army. And although the militia was, you know, played an important role at several battles, especially early and midway through the war, like places like Saratoga and Bunker Hill, the militia was something that was confounding and disappointing generals like George Washington over and over again.
Well, and that's, you know, a key issue. But the other issue is militia was not set up to oppose the state. It was almost always, as you point out in the documentary, under state control, correct?
Absolutely. And there's many provisions in the Constitution where any place you look in the Constitution that mentions the word militia, it mentions a place, you know, a circumstances under which the militia would be called out to aid the federal government, to literally help the government survive. Now it is true, Wade, that there were people at the time, you know, after the war for independence, we had just fought a war against a very distant and powerful central government. And to many Americans, there wasn't much of a stomach for setting up, you know, yet another distant, powerful central government. And there really were fears amongst, you know, some people that this government could get out of control and become too powerful. And just like the government of Great Britain would need to be opposed with some kind of military force. And so it is true that the militia, you know, this would be a very wild circumstance, but there did need to be made some allowance for it. But here's the thing, and we have this directly from, you know, founding fathers like James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. When it comes to the militia standing up against the encroaching, you know, a wildly out of control federal government, the militia is a unit of power that is wielded by the states. So, and back then, and even today, in every single state constitution, you know, we have our federal constitution, but we also have 50 state constitutions, and every single one of them says that the elected governor is the commander-in-chief of the state militia. So in this, you know, wild event where Americans were to pick up arms against their own federal government, it was the governors, it was the militia officers, it was this whole chain of command, beginning at the civilian level down, and with states working together, the states themselves were supposed to, you know, pick up arms against the federal government if we needed to. Not individuals, not people just deciding, screw this, let's fight the government. Even in the American Revolution, this was done on a state-by-state basis through legal and democratic means with Americans working together. That's what was going on in 1776. There were representatives from the states meeting in a Continental Congress. These were the men. These were elected, you know, authorized men who declared declared our independence and went about with Americans taking up arms.
And often the governors themselves were on the battlefield as you say, as commanders in chief. But this militia thing is, particularly in the western states and some other places here in the South, has been widely misunderstood. Our guy Patrick Henry, Mr. Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, was one of the ones who argued against the standing army. I learned that from the documentary, but the militia is absolutely something under state control, not something set up for the state. But the Second Amendment, in the originalist view, this was so important that we have this amendment. But you point out, and it's a great story in the documentary, much of this has to do with an election for Congress against two people who ended up as president, James Madison and James Monroe. Why don't you tell that story, because it's a fantastic historical tale.
Right. Wade, it's another, you know, great testament to the power of myth-making, because so many people on, you know, what we might call the pro-gun side of this issue would say that, like, all the founding fathers were unified and determined that, you know, this right be in the Constitution. And that's, if it's so important, that's why they made it the second one. And, you know, when you really look at the historical facts, none of that is true. First of all, we need to ask, you know, if this right was so tantamount to be protected, why didn't it make it into the Constitution when it was, you know, why did it have to be among the amendments that only came about years later? And, you know, and what you're, you know, very ably referring to is the sort of conundrum James Madison had. James Madison, you know, our fourth president, from Virginia, one of the real elites of American political power early in our history. He's sort of known as the father of the Constitution, and he's the one who was responsible for the Constitution being amended. But remember, the Constitution was James Madison's baby. He did not want it to be amended, and we have documents written in his hand that attest to his, you know, feeling like the whole idea of amending the Constitution was something he called a nauseous project. And the amendments that he did allow to go forward were things that he called conciliatory sacrifices. And, you know, he really was a person who drafted these amendments very much on his own. You know, when the Constitution was written and then it didn't become the force, didn't have the force of law until the states ratified it. And so, you know, some of the states, these were the people who had the ability to push back and say, this Constitution isn't good enough for us. We want changes to it.
And it's a political give and take. They got involved.
Absolutely. And so there were 13 states at the time. Five of them accepted the Constitution with no amendments, including southern states like Georgia and South Carolina did not ask for any amendments that had anything to do with the right to keep and bear arms. It was actually New York, North Carolina, and Virginia were the only states who asked for this amendment to be put forward. And even then, Wade, that was one among a long list of amendments, many of which had nothing to do with these sorts of individual rights. The people who didn't like the Constitution, like you mentioned, Patrick Henry, they had a lot of problems with it, and a lot of them were big structural issues. So James Madison had this political problem. You know, if there are some people who are just vocal enough to cause me problems, who want changes in the Constitution, how do I amend the Constitution in a way that changes it as little as possible? And so all the amendments that James Madison chose to put forward, and this, again, this was not the founding fathers working together. This was very much James Madison and then some people who were members of the first Congress, you know, meeting in New York City in 1789. This was not, you know, the great heavyweights of American history. This was a small number of people. It was really just Madison alone. And the amendments that he chose, including what became the Second Amendment, but to him was, you know, originally in drafted in the committee as the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, not so close to the first. These were things that were kind of like minimal changes to the Constitution, things that could make him seem like, yes, I'm changing the Constitution. But in reality, it's kind of a bait and switch thing because he's not changing it at all. And again, because the right to keep and bear individual firearms by responsible adult citizens was an uncontroversial thing in 1790s and for most of history, you know, most of American history until sometime in the 60s and 70s when this when the Second Amendment thing became a cudgel picked up by conservative groups.
And if it hadn't been a congressional election that James Madison had to win, he might not have made so many compromises. We're talking to Jonathan Hennessy, who's an author, well-read, the New York Times bestseller, but also has done this documentary, You Don't Understand the Second Amendment. Jonathan, how do you see this documentary fitting into this highly polarized debate the country's having?
Well, that's a great question, Wade. And one of the things that I need to say right at the top is I don't expect everyone – I think that, unfortunately, I think it's the truth that because these myths are so powerful and because at this point these myths have been in circulation for so long that they've sort of stagnated. And I think there's a large number of people whose brains are closed to the evidence and who don't want the evidence, who only will seek out things about the Second Amendment that will validate, you know, their own feelings, their own pre-established beliefs. A lot of people don't want their pre-established beliefs challenged. They just want them validated. So there's a lot of people whose minds won't be changed. But here's the thing. We're in this age of this pandemic, and, you know, it's terrible what's happening in the Southeast. But as many of these epidemiologists will tell you, something we're sort of working towards as a population is this herd immunity. If we can just get a critical mass of people who have had this contagion and then can go back out into society and go back to work, that will benefit the rest of us. And because the gun extremists have been so great in pushing their agenda and their, you know, their totally flawed history, if a critical number of people can reacquaint themselves with this history, with the true original vision of the Constitution, then I think that could be enough. Because in order to make these legal decisions stick, these legal decisions based on bad history, you know, federal judges, including those, you know, sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States, if their decisions are, that they make based on bad history sort of depend on, you know, the rest of us not knowing, not just sort of believing that they have the handle on American history that they need. And it will be much harder for, you know, it's very clear that most people in America, poll after poll shows this, that they are in favor of common sense gun laws. But it's one thing to make laws, and it's another thing to make them stick. And that's the problem that we're having right now, is that with so many people in positions of judges who are acting on this bad history, any common sense gun law that we can make will be challenged, and will be challenged, you know, based on this originalist pretext that the conservatives have. But they won't. But if enough Americans actually know the history, it will make it much more difficult for these judges to strike down the kind of common sense gun laws that we can pass. So it's a matter of, you know, really getting these ideas out there. And that's why I've made this free. That's why I've made this as a documentary that's easy to watch. I mean, you can sit down in a couple of hours and, you know, learn what it would take from reading hundreds and hundreds of books and law journals. It's just all about getting the information out there.
Of course, the National Rifle Association, NRA, is a hugely powerful lobby. Now, they've had one problem after another. Their tax exemption is being investigated. There seems to have been a lot of hanky-panky on the money from the top down, Wayne LaPierre on out. Somehow it's been Teflon so far. I mean, you read now that people are buying guns because of the pandemic, that there are record sales almost as high as in the immediate election of Obama. I mean, there's a real self-interest that some have in trying to promote these sort of wrong views of what the rights under the Second Amendment are, aren't there, Jonathan?
There are, Wade, and you know, I'm calling you from the West Coast, but I've spent a lot of time in all the states where your voice is heard, and you know, as much as one person can know, one of the best things about people in the Great Southeast is almost in no other part of the country. And I come from New England. Nowhere else do I hear the sort of, you know, plain spoken wisdom that, you know, people in the Southeast have. And one thing I've heard over and over is that you don't ask an encyclopedia salesman if you need encyclopedias. And people need to remember that the NRA they are representatives, they are a lobbying group from the gun manufacturing, you know, division of the economy. It is their job to sell guns to people. And they will literally do anything that's not illegal. They will say anything that's not illegal to say in order to get that job done. And you are literally, you know, if you're going to these people for an understanding of American history, then you're asking an encyclopedia salesman if you need encyclopedias.
It was interesting. There was an article, and I can't remember if it was Harper's or The Atlantic, where the reporter had visited meetings of something called the Socialist Rifle Association, arguing that there were a number of groups on the other side of the perspective that weren't sort of, you know, highly right-wing conservatives, who were saying, you know, we're okay with guns, but we don't want to go to the AR-15 level or to some of the ridiculous NRA arguments. I don't know if there's any traction there, but I thought it was a fascinating article.
It is fascinating, and it's fascinating when you look at the broad sweep of American history. And you know, there's so many times when the Second Amendment was not an issue, would never come up in society, would almost never come up in legal cases. But, you know, another interesting time when there was a spike in talking about the Second Amendment as an individual right, not talking about the militia, was in, you know, immediately before the Civil War, when there was this phenomenon, you know, called Bleeding Kansas, and the Second Amendment rights were touted by abolitionists from the North who were going into the then territory of Kansas and literally fighting people who would come up from the South. The big struggle was Kansas going to be a free state or a slave state? And Northeasterners were citing their Second Amendment rights and buying guns and moving to Kansas.
John Brown and, you know, the rest of the crowd. Jonathan, our time's getting short here. Tell people, you mentioned briefly a second ago, but people can get You Don't Understand the Second Amendment documentary. How do they get it? For free, I believe you said.
Yes, there's nothing to sign up for. There's nothing to register for. This is a documentary that's free for everyone to watch. And if you do, please share. Don't leave the computer algorithms to do it on their own. It's the easiest place to see it is just go to understandthesecondamendment.com. But it's also on YouTube, and it's on the, you know, totally ad-free Vimeo platform. But just go to understandthesecondamendment.com.
You've got it. Understandthesecondamendment.com. This is Jonathan Hennessy. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas, and as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.